This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm here today with Amit Gore from the University of Manchester. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you for having me.
I think even though you've been at the university for a couple of years now, you've somehow avoided coming on the show.
Yep, I somehow managed to, yep.
Yeah, which is much a shame because you've been doing some really interesting work with Neil Jackson here.
Yeah, it's evolved quite a bit from the project that I came here for initially,
Oh, so what were you originally working on?
Originally, well, half of the postdoc was dedicated for a LOFAR long baseline project, so it's an array coming online at very low frequencies across all of Europe, really, different telescopes scattered across all of Europe, and so I did work with Neil on a project with that, basically finding calibrators for it, because that's something that is difficult to do and not something you can do every time you need to do an observation, and you always need a calibrator. And the other half of my postdoc was for strong lensing stuff.
So, LOFAR, that's a radio telescope,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
And so what do you mean about calibrators? I have no idea about how any of this works.
Okay. So, it's an array of telescopes, so it's an interferometric radio telescope array. And whenever you do an observation with those, you have to have a flux calibrator and a phase calibrator. So you basically have to have a source, which is pretty stable and bright, nearby so that you can observe that every now and then to basically set a benchmark for your real observation. So at higher frequencies, it's pretty easy to get a calibrator, but at low frequencies, what tends to happen is the ionosphere becomes a problem. It varies very rapidly, and you need to have a calibrator very close by. There's a lot of math behind that, but basically because it's at a very low frequency, you need to have something close by, and you don't always know if you're going to be able to get that. So what we did is, it's basically, you can consider it kind of a community service project. We went through and looked for calibrators all across the sky. And so, I mean, Neil had been working with this with other people before I even came here. I mean, it finished while I was here, and it's grown to other things as well.
So what kind of objects are you typically looking for as calibrators?
So bright objects, basically. I think the basic strategy before I even came here was to find bright objects in pre-existing surveys, and focusing on those that are fairly flat spectrum, because if it's flat spectrum, it's likely to be bright at lower frequencies as well, and just observing those to see if they show up at lower frequencies. I don't know exactly what the fraction was, but I think Neil was happy with the results of how many turned out to be calibrators.
So you were saying things have kind of changed a lot since what you were originally planning here to come to do. Is that because you had more of a focus on lensing, or you've moved on to other things?
Maybe changed was the wrong word, but it's grown into a lot of interesting projects that I hadn't imagined doing beforehand. So it kind of transitioned into using strong lensing. So strong lensing isn't an end in itself, but it's a means to get to an end. So you use strong lensing as a tool to observe other objects or to constrain other properties of the universe. So I've never done cosmology with strong lensing before, and when I came here, there was a large shift to that. I mean, Manchester has a pretty large extragalactic, heavily cosmology-focused department here, and we continue that with strong lensing, which you don't hear about all the time because, you know, people always hear about weak lensing with respect to cosmology, but we're making strong lensing work too.
So how can you use strong lensing for cosmology?
A couple of ways. So you can do it statistically, similarly in a way that weak lensing does it. You have a lot of lenses, you observe a lot of them across a wide span of redshifts, and you can infer properties about the universe. So strong lensing, basically the way it comes down to it is, if you have an object that's being lensed, which is time variable, like a supernova or a quasar, then you can calculate something called the time delay, which basically means, you know, you get multiple images in strong lensing, so you can calculate how long it takes a little beam of light to get to one image versus how long it takes to get to another image. And with that difference in time, you can figure out the geometry of the universe, and you can drive a lot of cosmological parameters from that. So you can do it statistically like that. You can also do it using maybe one or two very good lenses that you observe very well. So if you find one lens that's really nice, get a lot of observations, you maybe get some velocity dispersions, a lot of other, you know, complementary data. Maybe it's even a double lens. Maybe you have multiple things being strongly lensed, and that gives you really good constraints. So even from one system alone, you can do quite a bit.
Which completely blows my mind, because in my head, cosmology is something where you need huge data sets observing lots and lots and lots of things to get the statistics. But to hear you can do it with just one or two fantastic objects is incredible.
Yeah. When you get some of these really good data, and you see an object that's been just stretched across the sky, and you have thousands of pixels in your image where you have just golden data, you can really pin down the constraints a little bit. And the methods have been getting more and more sophisticated. The data's been getting better and better, so the methods have to get better and better. But inevitably, that means that you have to account for more and more astrophysics. You have to account for more things in your own algorithms that might be wrong, or things that could have messed up your observations in the first place, like things along the line of sight. Maybe it's scattering in the ionosphere, or maybe it's reddening from the galaxy, assuming the lensing itself. So you have to start thinking more about some of the effects that could be affecting your data. But people in the past few years really have taken off this and started to really focus on sources of systematics, and beating down those systematics is a game at this point.
What do you think Strom lensing offers to cosmology over other cosmological probes?
Complementarity. Mm-hmm. So it's never good to tackle a problem from one angle only. I mean, maybe it's efficient, but that's not something you know when you're doing the thing itself. Maybe you look back in hindsight and you know that, oh, well, that was the way to go. When you're doing something, you always want to attack it from multiple angles. Mm-hmm. This is, I guess, I'm speaking very generally at this point. And strong lensing does that. It gives you a complementary approach to do it. Not only is it an independent method, but even in terms of degeneracies between cosmological parameters, strong lensing breaks those degeneracies, because if there's a degeneracy in two-dimensional plane and there's a degeneracy in two cosmological parameters, weak lensing might be degenerate in one way and strong lensing might be degenerate in a completely opposite way that helps to minimize the overall degeneracy or even break it completely. And that's actually what it does do, especially if you have multiple things being strongly lensed. If you have double lenses, then you really start to get strong constraints and break down these degeneracies. Now, strong lensing has its limits. It's not as good as pinpointing some of the more exotic cosmological parameters, and especially in more exotic models, so models where the dark energy equation of state is changing or something like that, strong lensing may not be so good, but for things like the Hubble constant, it's great.
Is that because of assumptions you have to make in using strong lensing for that, or is it that strong lensing isn't good enough yet, but it will be one day?
It's both. So it's a bit of the methods are still getting there, and it's a little bit of we don't have enough objects that we've analyzed yet. There's one project in strong lensing called the Holy Cow Project, which is basically looking at a handful of lenses and looking at them very well, getting lots of data on them, analyzing the neighborhoods of the galaxies, things along the line of sight, and they're pinpointing down cosmology using that. And right now they only have 3 objects. They will have 5 soon, and then they expand that even more to tens and tens. You can already pin down the Hubble constant pretty well. But once they get into the tens of objects and one day into the hundreds, then you'll be able to pin down these more exotic cosmological parameters even better.
And what have you specifically been working on?
I've been working on looking at the systematics and the methods themselves. So actually, I did that in my PhD. I looked at systematic uncertainties in lens modeling algorithms. Here at Manchester, I've also done that, but I've done it with respect to what the Holy Cow Project is doing. So they're doing it with real lenses. I looked at simulations, the Eagle Project, and basically simulated strong lenses in there and analyzed that with a similar methodology to see what systematic biases can pop up. Mm-hmm. Are we accounting for them? So I've done that. I've also looked at a handful of lenses themselves, and I've also done a bit of software development. So Manchester has a very strong radio astronomy community, and so naturally I extended some code that I'd written in my PhD to work with radio interferometric data, which is a completely different ballgame, because when you look at optical telescope, you get pixels and kind of what NASA will show you, or ESO will show you, pretty pictures. But when you look at the sky with a radio interferometer, what you see is something completely different. You see something in Fourier space, so it's not what our eye sees, it's something else. And to handle that kind of data, you have to kind of start from scratch a bit. So mm-hmm. I did that. And I've also worked with some other groups here. Upcoming surveys are going to see a lot of lenses, so I've been making predictions of what kind of constraints mm-hmm. those surveys and lenses from those surveys, like the Euclid telescope survey. I've been looking at what kind of constraints we'll be able to do on other things like galaxy evolution based mm-hmm. on that.
So going back to the work you said you've been doing with the Eagle simulations, so this set of realistic mini-universe simulations, what have you been doing with that, and why does Eagle help you do that specifically?
Well, Eagle, it's the biggest and baddest of simulations that's around. So mm-hmm. if you want something that looks the most like what we see in the sky, you go to Eagle. It has advantages over Illustrious because Eagle gets the sizes of galaxies right. And that's really important for us because when we're trying to simulate lenses, we need to get the galaxy sizes right because the Einstein radius is going to be very similar to the effective radius of the galaxies, the size of the galaxies. And that'll affect the lensing properties that we derive very significantly.
What's the Einstein radius for the lens?
Let's say you have a lens and a source that are aligned on the sky, right, one right behind the other. Then the Einstein radius would be the radius at which you get multiple images.
Okay, so the kind of scale at which you're going to see your effects.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And if the galaxy size is also on the same scale, then you've got to be careful.
Okay, so it's really important to use these Eagle simulations, which are, I should have said, they're a big collection of galaxy formation simulations, because they get those sizes right. And
yeah, mm-hmm. you get the sizes right, and it accounts for the effects of baryons, of gas and stars. It accounts for the effects of those things on the scales that we're trying to probe here with strong lensing. And that is something that has really only been available to us recently. Before that, it was only dark matter simulations, and couldn't really do lensing on galaxy scales. Maybe cluster scales, but not mm-hmm. galaxy scales.
So what did you find looking into the systematics using Eagle?
We found that what the HolyCow project is doing seems to be okay. We pulled out the lenses and then we modeled them using power law models and using velocity distortions measurements that we also got from the simulation. And it worked out. Mm-hmm. So one thing that was kind of maybe not so sure at the beginning was, are power law assumptions okay? So basically that means we're describing the radial density profile of the galaxy using a power law. So something like the density is something like the radius raised to some power of some power, yeah. And it's not clear why that should be the case, because nothing in nature says that it has to be that way. You know, galaxies have dark matter components that we know of now. It has gas components, it has star components, and those aren't individually power law models, so why would you expect it to be? But it turns out it was pretty good. I mean, the HolyCow project still has, I think, a bit of ways to come. There's still some things they have to address, which I think they are now. But so one of the things that I think that they might need to do is maybe how you model velocity dispersion measurements themselves. So right now I think they're using a spherical model to model velocity dispersions, and galaxies aren't spherical. They're ellipsoidal, they're triaxial. So when we were looking at the Eagle simulation to assess the biases and the algorithms themselves, we were using triaxial ellipsoidal models. And we actually didn't look at what happens if you don't do that. So if you were just to make the more simplistic assumptions that people have made in the past, do you still get it wrong or do you still get it right? We didn't do that, but what we did do is said, if you go ahead and you do it the right way, well, I guess what I expect would be the right way, modeling it using triaxial ellipsoids, then you do get it right at least.
So you're setting the bar high.
I think so, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now that we have the framework all set up, we can always just dumb it down a bit and focus on spherical models. It's a particular case of an ellipsoidal model. So thinking about it now, yeah, this might just give me some ideas now. We can go back and see if the spherical model is as bad as I suspect it might be, or if I'm just making a mountain out of a molehill.
That's interesting to find out that you didn't find any major issues with the HolyCow approach. If you, as a simulator, you find actually the observer's technique has been great all along. It's great for them, but it's bad for your paper. Whereas if your paper came out and said, oh God, no, it's awful, then obviously you would make a big splash and everyone would pay attention. But actually, we need papers like that to be testing what people are doing and to be showing, actually, yeah, that technique works.
It's the dreaded null result, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's one thing that's, I think, huge in biological sciences. Whenever they get a null result, they don't want to publish it. Mm. But I think it's important to, you know, one, it tells people, okay, well, it was right all along or it wasn't right all along. And two, somebody else won't do it later on down the road.
That's true. Yeah. You kind of avoid that duplication of research.
Yeah, exactly.
So you said you kind of moved more to using lensing for cosmology once you moved to Manchester. What kind of thing were you working on before you came here? And where were you?
I was doing my PhD at Rutgers University back in the States. There I was using strong lensing to focus more on the galaxies that are being lensed themselves. So these are usually high redshift galaxies, and I was looking at particularly starburst galaxies. So we had multi-wavelength data. We had some great optical data, carbon monoxide data, which is radio. Did other kinds of data as well.
So is that where you got your first taste of radio data?
It was, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't doing what is the most correct way to do it, which is working with the Fourier space data that comes from the telescopes themselves. Back then, I was just working with the image plane data, which I think was okay for that particular object. For some, it's okay. For some, it's not. I think it was okay for that one. But yeah, we were just focusing on the objects, trying to get their properties down. Starburst galaxies are especially interesting because they occur mainly at the peak of star formation, so when most of the galaxies are starting to go through their starburst phases, and it's just for studying galaxy evolution, it's important to pin down their properties, how massive they are, how fast they form stars, how long they last, IMF normalizations, a lot of different things. Strong lensing was a fun way to look at it because it can go deeper, meaning you can see fainter objects or you can see not so faint objects even better and get better estimates of their properties. It's kind of pushing the limits there.
So you get the magnification, obviously, which helps you to see those fainter objects. But is that kind of counterbalanced by the difficulty in reconstructing the sources, or is that fairly straightforward?
That is an excellent point. Yeah. It depends on how good your algorithms are. If you have really good algorithms, then you can account for a lot of different effects. And, yeah, I think people are getting more and more confident in the results you get from those. But sometimes, you know, there's things that you just can't account for, like line-of-sight effects. You just don't know what might be there. So what you do is you just throw in an extra error budget, which basically makes everything less precise. The measurements you get back from lensing have bigger error bars on them because you can't account for some of these things. So there are things like that that will just be there, I think. But I think more often than not, or at least nowadays, just the quality of data and how deep you can go makes up for that.
And what are you looking forward to in the future for, like, looking more at the field generally of strong lensing or strong lensing for cosmology? What interests you the most?
I'm really curious in rare objects, like these double lenses I mentioned earlier, and even triple lenses. We're expected to get a handful of those from these large surveys coming up, like Euclid or LSST. Those alone by themselves will give such good constraints on cosmology. I'm looking forward to those quite a bit. And there are other objects that are also rare objects, like lens supernovae. If it's a type 1A supernovae, it's kind of what's called a standard candle. Mm-hmm. So you can nail down things like the magnification of the object, the absolute magnification of the object itself, which will help to break down a lot of systematics in lensing, one of which is the mass sheet degeneracy. So when you get these rarer objects, you can do even better. And I think one of the best things will be what we don't even expect. So I imagine they'll give us like weird things, like maybe we'll see a lens where there's no galaxy, there's no luminous counterpart, and then we'll have to look at that and say, oh, there's no light, but there's clearly a lot of mass here, what's going on? So, you know, the unexpected, I think, will be
like
interesting.
A clump of dark matter is a lens, is that what you mean? Or?
Yeah, yeah, so maybe there'll be a galaxy that just doesn't shine very brightly at all, but it still happens to produce a lens. So we've seen, I think there's some local objects which seem to be quite massive, but don't have a lot of luminous matter. And people, I think, are trying to understand those. But if we see more of those and at different redshifts, then it'll add to the mystery.
No, that does sound cool. When you were thinking about these kind of rarer objects, you were saying like the double and triple lenses, is there any estimates of how many of those we expect to be able to find, or is it fairly unknown?
There's been some estimates. I know for Euclid, at least. There's one guy who's written a program called, I think, LensPop is the name or something, and there's maybe a couple of others, but it's just basically simulated lenses, and I think you're going to find hundreds of double lenses and maybe tens of triple ones, I think. So there'll be a good amount of double lenses, yeah. Definitely. And so it's more, like you said, you know, when you get good data, you get these rare objects, it's more complicated because with a double lens, it's not just that you have two things that are doing the lensing. Now, one of the things that's being lensed is also a lens of the other object even farther away from us that's also being lensed.
So I think I had the wrong idea about what a double lens is. So is that essentially three objects along the line of sight?
Pretty much,
they're all at different redshifts.
Exactly.
I was thinking of it as like two objects at a similar redshift and one further back. But that's even more complicated. How do you disentangle, especially a triple lens, how does that work?
If you have really good data, if you have velocity dispersion measurements of these things as well, if you have velocity dispersion measurements, and if you can get spatially resolved velocity dispersion measurements, and that helps to break down a lot of the degeneracies in this kind of a system.
Velocity dispersions of the lenses.
The lens, definitely.
Or of the source.
If you can get the source, fantastic. Okay. But if you can get the lens, that's great. And maybe use some assumptions. Maybe you know how bright one of the objects is. And maybe you can kind of put some priors on how massive you expect it to be.
But how would you know how bright it is? Because you don't know if it's lens. How does that work?
Once you have a pretty rough lens model, you can kind of estimate how much it's been magnified within 10% or so.
So you get like a range, you have an idea of where it should lie, roughly.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, yeah. Unless you're unlucky and there's just like a satellite galaxy that's just really near it, or right on top of it even, then the uncertainty goes through the roof.
How come?
Just because it's so close to it. So if you have a main lens that's causing this, doing the lensing, and you have a satellite galaxy near one of the images, that satellite galaxy near one of the images might be way less massive, but it's much closer. And what that means is it has its own critical curves, basically, which are invisible lines that we made up where the magnification is infinite. But anyway, you have these critical curves that are very near the image, and but you're far away from one of these critical curves, the magnification doesn't change very rapidly. It's pretty much constant. But once you get close to the critical curves, the magnification starts changing rapidly. So that's why even something small and not so massive, but close by, can be a big problem.
Okay, that makes sense. I've never come across that before. So, yeah, we talked about what we're kind of looking forward to in the field generally. What about you? Do you know what your next steps are? Or are you...
I think this is my last roundup to bat, so I won't be doing another postdoc. I was considering another postdoc here in the UK, but I'll be going back to the States, especially because my partner is there. And so I'll just be applying to jobs outside of academia.
Well,
I'll probably stay in touch with people here and there, finishing up some loose ends, but yeah. Mm. Yeah.
It'll be sad to lose you. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on the Dreadcast. It's been great to hear about some strong lensing.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.